Hey, got the morning show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Stephanie Felt. Welcome, Stephanie.
Good morning, everybody. Morning, Aaron.
Enjoy the wind out there, did you?
Well, I'm a bit windswept and interested, yeah. Aren't I?
A little bit. Oh, I watched you coming across the road as quickly as you could to get out of the wind this morning. So Stephanie is a neuro-linguistic programming practitioner and trainer, but also that's where you started with this, but we call what we do here Inside Your Mind because it's more than just that. Mm. Today you want to talk about training and education. And is there a difference between training and education?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, some people go, oh, I'm going on a training course, and they go for like 3 hours or something, and at the end of it, they can't do anything different than when they went. I mean,
they've got a piece of paper.
They might have a piece of paper, or they might have just more knowledge about something. And I think that's really important, the difference between having knowledge about something, yeah, and being able to develop new skills and change behaviours. So I'll call the first one education and the second one is training.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a bit naughty, but to explain the difference, imagine that you've got a 16-year-old and they come home from school and they go, you say to them, well, what did you learn at school today? And they say, oh, we had sex training today. Right. As opposed to, well, we had sex education. You know, you might be freaking out a bit if they said that at sex training, because that implies that it's very practical, doesn't it?
Yes, there's a practical component
to training.
Yeah.
Whereas education, it could be that you want to know, you know, some more about how your DNA is collected and how it's used and all that kind of stuff, and that's knowledge.
Yeah, but this,
but you can't do anything practical necessarily with it. Or you might want to learn about 12th century France or something like that. You know, again, you can't do anything with it apart from it's good knowledge. It's not, I'm not saying it's bad, but if you want to change behaviour and you want to get more skills, then you need some kind of training to do that, where you're practicing the skills and getting feedback on how well you're doing, and then, you know, once you leave the training, practicing it further so that it becomes part of who you are and what you do, rather than something that you just do when you remember it, you know.
I was about to say, then, therefore, is there any point to the knowledge? But the whole point of, like, you're using, continuing your example, sex ed in schools.
Yeah.
The whole point is that age group has no trouble getting some practice, but but it's the knowledge to go with it. Right. Famously, there are many who have trouble. They would love to have some practice, but aren't. But the point is, the school and the adult system is trying to provide some knowledge into that. So yeah.
There's another
knowledge does have a point.
It does have a point. It's like because it's I call it head knowledge. It's stuff that you know about, but not necessarily that you can do. You know, another example is the reason that people can't drive on the roads when they've just taken the written examination for driving. You know, because there's like, well, they've got the theory now.
Yeah.
So, you go, here's a car, here's the keys, off you go. You know, can you imagine the devastation, right?
Yes.
Because no practical ability yet to, or limited practical ability at that stage to actually drive.
And the process of acquiring that sort of knowledge is different from acquiring information. Like information, you can just get it, like you tell me, I've got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, that's a much slower process.
And there's also, you know, in my experience, there's some people that when they've got the knowledge, they think that they have the skill.
Yeah.
Because they've got the head knowledge. And you know, examples that sometimes when I'm training people, I have people come on the course that are often, you know, senior people in an organisation. And what I've found is they don't want to do the practical skills, the practical exercises on the course to embed the knowledge. They just want enough knowledge, head knowledge, to be able to tell other people what to do. And I go, no, not on my course, sorry. if you're gonna do the thing, you've got to do it properly, you know, because there's a big difference between telling somebody what to do when you've got the head knowledge and you haven't got the actual skill and behaviour change yourself.
And we can usually feel that.
Hmm. You can feel
when you're giving someone information that you're just passing on, you don't feel like it doesn't feel the same as when you're giving information that you've earned yourself. If you see what I mean, Like if you're telling someone how to drive, but you don't know how to drive.
Oh, right. Yeah. That, well, it's kind of you're not walking your talk, are you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you feel, and you can feel it.
Mm.
Yeah. But you're saying there's a type of manager who doesn't walk any of the talk.
Well, I think there's loads of managers like that, yeah.
Yeah.
They've got lots of education and lots of knowledge,
yeah,
but not necessarily the practical skills. And having said that, you can't expect everybody to have practical skills in every aspect of their job.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, you'd spend your whole life just doing that. But as I say, the main thing is what to think about what you want. What do you want to achieve? If you're going to go and learn something, is it something that you're just learning out of interest, like you want to learn about your ancestry or something, you know, so that you can put a family tree together?
Yeah.
I call that kind of head knowledge. There is a kind of a practical ability to it, but it's not anything that any behaviour change or anything that you need to do.
Yeah.
Or is it something that you want to be able to embody and use on a day-to-day basis? Then you're looking at a training course, which usually means that it's going to be a bit longer, and you know there'll be things to practice so that the trainer can see that you can do it, and you get feedback so that when you leave, you're actually doing what you've been taught to do. Because I've been on training courses, for example, where people are taught something and they go, okay, go away and practice, but there's no demonstration. And so you look around and everybody's doing the exercise differently. And it's like, well, this is no good because, you know, nobody's saying, oh, that's incorrect. And so whatever you learn on the course, then you're going to continue to practice that when you leave, which if it's not right, then that could be a problem, you know. So then that's another thing about training is do you get a demonstration of what it is that you're going to practice so that you know that you're practicing correctly, and is somebody watching to make sure that you're doing it correctly and giving you feedback?
Actually, that's another thing too about that level of training. It's very hard to make it work by giving head knowledge.
Exactly.
And your example there is perfect, where if they demonstrated it, everyone would have been like, ah, got yep. it, because you see so much more stuff than you can, yep. in terms of information, than you get by giving it in word form.
Yeah, and because a lot of people are visual learners, so they see it, and then they're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, and then they can look at, you know, the instructions and check it yeah. with what they're seeing, and then also they're hearing it as well, and then they actually get to experience it themselves. And if they get stuck, there's somebody there to say how to get unstuck and what's happening, so that they really understand it and they've physically done the exercise so that they've got an experience of it.
Another thing too, I thought of a difference, is that the head knowledge you can forget, but the training from doing things is much harder to forget.
Mm.
I think
because you've embodied it, you've physically done it, you've experienced it through language, and you've experienced it through actually seeing the result in another person or in yourself.
Yeah, when I train up DJs for the studio, I get them to sit in this chair. I'm sitting in the chair by the mixing desk, and I sit where you are.
Yeah,
and I tell them what to do, and then they do it.
Yeah.
As I'm talking them through it.
Yeah,
because it's. Especially with computer stuff, you can whiz around with a mouse and people are like completely lost.
Well, exactly. And you've got like four screens here.
Oh, five. There's actually five in the room. But
is that? Where's the one? Yeah. Is that the one? The camera's
two, three,
watching
four,
me.
Five.
Oh, there's one down there as well.
Oh, six.
Six.
Yeah, we don't use that one. That's like several meters away. And that's my laptop. It's just these three.
Okay. And then your mixing board there and your keyboard, you know, so and whatever that is over there, that console thing with...
That's a stereo. Do you remember those?
I was going to say it looks like he's got a tape deck in the bottom.
It has. It has got a tape deck and it works too. I fixed it the other day because someone wanted to get something off a tape a little while ago.
Right.
And the thing was so odd that it has rubber bands in it, and the rubber bands had just perished. They were turning to goo. This is a complete aside, but yes, we can take your tapes, folks. CDs, records, anything, we can do it.
We can do it. Right?
Yeah, old MP3 players, no worries.
Oh, that's good to know. So what were we? I forgot what we were talking about.
The difference between it's training, and I was talking about when I train people up on here. I even get them to sign the day book when you come in. I even get to physically do that usually during the training as well. It's because I won't remember. I know for myself, I'm probably a bad case, but if you just tell me something, I'm pretty sure I won't remember it.
Well, what do they say? If you tell somebody and they forget, I can't remember the actual quote now, but when they do it, they remember. So tell us.
So there's one I know. If you tell something, they'll forget. If you teach them, they'll remember. If you let them experience it, they'll learn.
Yeah, that's right. If you show them, they'll remember. If they experience it, they'll learn. Something like that, anyway. Yeah. So we want to do all three, really. So, you know, when I'm training, I give people the theory and I'll show them like a process on my flip chart and an overview, and then I'll do a demonstration of it. And then we'll go over the details of it, and then they have a practice. So
how much theory do you give?
There's not a lot of theory in NLP. There's probably enough for people to, because some people are quite intellectual and they like all the theory.
Yeah.
So enough that they feel satisfied, and that's different for each person. So often when I'm explaining something, and when I invite questions all the time, so somebody might say, "Oh, well, you know, how does that work with this?" or "What's the reason for that?" kind of thing. And so I'll answer that question and give them some more depth to it. And it's not that I'm withholding stuff; it's just that I want it to be clean, so that they. I'm not teaching things that they haven't learnt. I'm not encouraging them to do things that they haven't learnt yet. So I want to keep to whatever it is I'm teaching them to do, but answer the questions so that they feel comfortable that they've got enough knowledge to do the exercise.
Do you find also that sometimes it's easier for people to remember the theory after they've done the exercise?
Yes,
like if you can then go back at that point and say, "This is why we did that."
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, after each exercise as well, we get everybody back and go, okay, what did you learn? What did you learn from that?
Yeah.
And so they're learning then not only what they learned, but also what other people learned from the exercise, which is really useful. So that discussion. And there was something else I was going to say about that. And it's gone completely out of my mind now. Anyway, we'll come back to it. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, that's interesting because people aren't very good at – we're not very good machines for learning 100% of the information someone's trying to give.
Mm.
And that's so in a group you'll have people go, "Oh, I learned this," and someone else will be like, "I don't even remember that."
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think, what I was wanting to talk about really was, you know, how people learn different things because, you know, obviously on the training I'm talking about is my NLP practitioner training, which starts on the 21st of August.
You've got a new one coming out. That's a three-week thing, is it?
Yeah, three six-day blocks.
Right.
One in August, one in September, and one in October. And so that's 18 days of training. And so it's a pretty extensive kind of training. It's quite intense from 9 till 6 each day. And then people go, "Well, what do people learn?" And it's like, well, I say, "Okay, have you got 18 days?"
I'll tell you.
So I'll give examples, but, you know, and I'll give you a couple of examples because, you know, if when people say, what's NLP, there's a couple of kind of definitions like...
Yeah, we didn't do that at the start, so people might...
Well, it's all neuro-linguistic programming. So some definitions are, it's the study of human excellence. So that's by John Grinder, one of the co-developers. The science of programming your own brain. The study of subjective experience, how people know what they know and do what they do. But, you know, I've said all those, but now you're none the wiser, are you? It's just giving
you...
Well,
they're very different.
Well, they seem to be, but that's what I mean. And then it's like, well, okay, that's interesting, but how does it apply to me? And that's the problem, is that because it's 18 days, you know, it's like a complete transformation of people. And
but there's also words, like words actually have really complex meanings, which you discover when you try to translate languages. And you ask someone, what does that word mean in your language? And you get this big, long explanation because there isn't a perfect translation.
No.
And they have to give you all the nuance. And you think, man, that language is really deep and subtle and not like mine. But ours is too. We just take it all for granted.
Exactly. You know, because the linguistic is so important in this, it's the middle part of neuro-linguistic programming. But it's not just the words that we use, it's our body language, it's the level of rapport we have with people, it's how we move our eyes, it's whether our skin colour changes, it's all kinds of things, anything that's conveying a message. So it's not just language, but language is really important. But sometimes giving some specific examples is useful. So I've got a few here that I'll tell you about. So one was, I've used different names. So Jenny, a 32-year-old mother of two preschoolers, the kids wouldn't settle at bedtime, and she used to spend ages trying to get them to sleep. Often she'd fall asleep herself in the process.
Oh, yeah, I used to do that, yeah.
Getting them to sleep. It's quite common. So she used the NLP rapport processes and specific language patterns that she learnt on the course to help her children calm down and get off to sleep easily.
Okay.
So it's like one specific example, and then people will go, well, you mean they did 18 days just for that? And I go, no, they don't do 18 days just for that. That's just one example, right?
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of other things as well. Another one is Martin, an engineer. So this guy was an engineer, used to working with other engineers, and then he was promoted, and he was in charge of a team of non-engineering staff. And he said he couldn't get his team to listen to him or do what he asked, and then he'd become all defensive and stubborn about what he wanted to do. And so he used some NLP listening skills to better understand his crew, because he thought that they were just getting at him all the time. And in fact, you know, these guys had been working in the job for like 20 or 30 years, and he'd just come in, and they were trying to explain to him how they could do things differently. But he thought that they were just challenging him, and he was getting quite... not aggressive, but feeling aggressive towards them because he didn't think they were listening to him. So instead of then getting worried and uptight, he used an NLP anchoring technique to be relaxed when he talked to them. And then he used the NLP listening skills to understand what they were doing and realise that actually they've got better ideas about some things than he had, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was really useful. And again, you know, is that the only thing he learnt? No, that's just an example, right? Then there was another one, Margot, who found it challenging to connect to a boss. And they just get really frustrated with each other to the point where Margot was considering another job. So when on the course, what happened is she became aware of the fact that she needed lots of details in order to do a job.
Yeah.
But her boss didn't want any details. He was like a big picture person. And so when she'd go in and start talking to him in details, he'd go into a trance because he'd be overwhelmed with all the details and giving, you know, and this blow-by-blow account of what she'd done. And he'd be like overwhelmed with all that, and she just thought he wasn't interested.
Yeah.
So what she had to learn was that some people don't need detail, and, you know, and to teach him that she sometimes needed more detail, and to ask then specific questions to get the details she needed to do a job,
yeah,
and then just give him the overview of what she'd done.
Generally, you'd think the boss wouldn't want too much detail because they've got, if they had all the detail from all the different departments, then they'd just get overwhelmed.
Exactly.
Even if they were a detail person.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, though, is that if the person is a detail person and they haven't realised that other people are different, because this, yeah, is the thing, is that we often, you know, we know everybody's different, but sometimes we just hope that everybody's the same as us because it's to make life easier. And realising that, you know, it wasn't the boss's fault and it wasn't her fault, it was just a difference in how they like to process information. So if she didn't have the details, she couldn't do a job.
Yeah.
And that was the other part. He'd give her vague instructions because that's all he needed. But it wasn't enough for her, and so she'd be constantly going back. And so it was like, ask these particular questions and you'll get the information you need to do the job.
What sort of, like, can you give us an example of a question?
Aside from,
tell me what to do next.
Yeah, he might say, oh, you know, I need a report on absenteeism. And so their questions would then be, okay, for example, do you want it divided into male and female? Do you want it over a certain period of time? And, you know, like, and then it forces the boss to think, oh, actually, what do I want? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, male and female would be good. You know, maybe we'll go from the 1st of April to the end of July.
Yep.
And so he can get more, whereas he's got that in the back of his mind, but not the detail. Whereas by asking the questions, it's forcing him to go, oh, yeah, okay, I need to be a bit more specific. So it's kind of teaching him something as well.
Yeah, what usually happens, as I've seen in the past, is that after a while the staff get to know the boss, and they know when the boss says, I need an absentee report, they sort of instinctively know how to deliver what he wants without him explaining it.
Mm.
But that takes several months to get your staff to that point.
Well, I can give you an example, a personal experience. When I was in human resource management, I had nine staff, and they were excuse me, there were the health and safety guy, the warehouse people, the payroll master, and a couple of other people in that area. And, you know, looking back on it now, of course, you know, they're all detailed people because that's the nature of the job.
Yeah.
But I wasn't. I was a big picture person. And so I'd be the person that goes, oh, can you give me an absentee report, or can you give me a report on the safety issues or whatever it was, you see? Because if somebody said that to me, then I'd go, yeah, that's all I need. And if they started giving me the details, I'd be like, you know, shut up. Don't tell me how to do it. Just tell me what you want and I'll do it, right?
Yeah.
So I was always taught that you treat people as you want to be treated.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what I'd do is I'd just do the same for them. I think, oh, I'm not going to insult them by giving them all these details.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then I think it was a couple of years before I left there, we did these, they're called work styles profiles. And it was like a circular graph. It looked a bit like an astrology chart or something, but it told you different aspects of yourself. And so one of the things that I had on a scale of 1 to 9 was need for rules and supervision. Okay. And mine was 0. Right. So it went from 0 to 9. It was like, okay. So not only did I not need rules and supervision, but I'm pretty good at breaking them and making my own up, right?
Blundering through them.
I'm pretty good at making them for other people.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And so, and I went, oh, my God, you know. And then I got all my staff to do one. And they were all between 5 and 9.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my God, I've been driving them nuts. I've been driving them absolutely nuts. And the other thing was their liking for detail. Mine was 0.
Yeah.
Liking for detail. And theirs was between 7 and 9. Which, I mean, it's obvious because that's their job. But
yeah.
Again, with these two things, it was a real insight for me because I realised that I've basically been driving them up the wall by giving them all these vague instructions because I was treating them as I wanted to be treated. I thought I was a wonderful boss until then. And then it was like, okay, well, I've got new stuff to learn, right?
And what happens to you when you're forced into a situation where you have to do detail work?
Oh, I have all these measures in place, like... Like if I'm writing something, when I've written it, I'll leave it and read it again, and I'll also yes. have my computer speak the text, so it reads it back to me because I can't see the mistakes I've made because I just read what I think I wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it speaks back, I can hear it, oh, that's a mistake, right, and so I can correct it that way, or I might ask somebody to look at it for me.
You're definitely on the end of the scale because I thought I was pretty extreme on that, but I don't need it to be read back to me. I do need to take a break and come back and read it.
Yeah.
But it's usually, the biggest problem is the worst time is if I'm in a hurry and then I don't read it through thoroughly, which people who get regular communication from me will know about. but if I take my time, okay. Yeah.
I'm too impatient to take my time though. So either I'll try and write an article 3 or 4 days before I want to send it out so I've got a chance to check it, or use the speak text. I find that really useful for me.
But do you get lost in details? Like I can get lost in details, especially.
Oh yeah, it's just overwhelming. Yeah.
Especially when I've had jobs in the past where, like working at architects' offices, where I was running the project, but also it was a little project, so I was also doing all the details.
Yeah.
And I actually found that incredibly hard. I'd get lost in the details and forget the big picture, and I'm naturally a big picture person. Mm. So I never really found a way to cope with that.
Mm.
And the thing is that there's a career I left and do other things, but it made it look like I was bad at the job, and so you don't get promoted to the point where you're doing the big picture stuff because you weren't good at the detailed stuff.
Right.
I mean, I never that none of that ever came up because I left after really early on. But yeah,
it's a different skill. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know, like in a big company like where you've worked where you're the HR person, like the knowledge is there to look at a staff member and go, okay, they might actually be good at managing things because they're bad at the detail.
Mm.
Right? You might want them doing that. But in the places where I was, there wasn't that knowledge. It was just like, oh, that guy is not very good.
Well, interesting, going back to when I was in HR, it was a power company. One of the guys I employed was an apprentice, an electrician. And I know that if he was sitting here, he'd say he was pretty useless at it because he was a big picture person.
Yeah.
And now he's got, well, I don't know how many companies that he owns.
Yeah.
And last year he got leader of the year. And he texted me and said, I got leader of the year because you employed me. I said, no, it wasn't because I employed you.
Yeah, it wasn't the only reason.
It was because you got a big picture. But, you know, he still had potential, but as an electrician, you need the detail.
Yes.
So he did other
safety
things,
is very detail orientation for safety stuff, very important.
And this was before I knew about this work style profile thing. And he's amazing. You know, he's got a big picture view and he's got all these companies. He's got hundreds of people employed in New Zealand and overseas now as well.
Yeah.
You know, so that's an example of somebody that's got the big picture, but you know that they can't get involved in the detail because they wouldn't be able to do the big picture. Then
there also might be a tendency for the people who are big picture think, or the people who are detail thinkers, to think the boss is an idiot because they don't understand all the details.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and so it's called global and specific. So a global person obviously has the big picture, and a specific person has the detail. And often there's a whole group of about something like 60% that are in the middle that can do both. It's when you get the two extremes, when you get somebody that's a big picture and somebody that's detail, and they don't understand why they're not getting along, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, often the detail person, this particular person, was thinking about leaving because they couldn't seem to get through to the boss.
Yeah.
And the boss didn't want to lose them because they were really good at the detail, but he couldn't understand them. So, you know, it's an example of, first of all, head knowledge, and then how does this apply to you in your job? Where do you think you are on this scale? And
then you've got to put some stuff into practice.
Yeah, and then how can you put it into practice, you know? So one guy was very, very detailed, and what I had to teach him was how to give a summary or an overview, and then put the details at the bottom. Because the details, if people are detailed, the details are really important to people who are detailed.
Yeah.
But they might not be to the person that presenting the information to. So I go, give them an overview. It's like giving them, it's like giving somebody a whole pile of clothes and you just chuck them on the floor, right? If you give them some coat hangers to hang them on, they can see which are trousers and which are tops and which are underwear, you know, whereas if it's just in a big heap, they can't work out what's what.
Yeah.
So once they do that, then they can put the details in the bottom, and if people want to read it, they can read it, and if they don't, then they don't have to.
Yeah. The other thing too is, I get older, because I'm not a detailed person, I cope with it less and less. Because when I was young, I could hold everything. If people tell me lots of stuff, I could just hold it all in my head and then gradually make sense of it.
Yeah.
I think it gets harder as you get older, or you get less interested in doing it. I think I'm less interested in doing it too.
Well, it's interesting because I've found that people who are detailed, like, they get more detailed as they get older. And so maybe it's the opposite as well, is that people who aren't detailed, who are more global, get more global as they get older.
Maybe
we're just making it all up.
I think we're less flexible as we get older. We can't go into that other area.
Well,
so much.
See, I think that's the thing is that do we get less flexible as we get older, or is that just a belief that's been promulgated, you know?
Yeah. Maybe we don't have to be as flexible when we get older. Like when you're young, you're like, you go with whatever people tell you to do or whatever's going on around you. And as you get older, you're required to do that less. Like, I'm in charge here, so I don't have to bend to other people's requirements like I used to when I was in my 20s, you know?
Right, right.
So, yeah, maybe I'm out of the habit.
I don't know about that. Because I think sometimes that's a decision as well. It's like, well, I don't have to do it, so I won't. But other times it might be, well, I want to be more flexible. You know, like, how can I become more flexible in how I operate, you know, rather than this, you know, so it's a kind of global thing that, you know, as you get older, you get less flexible. But does it have to be true?
Yeah.
Because if you make a decision that you want to be more flexible, you know, then it's like, okay, so how do I be more flexible? Well, it might mean going out on a Wednesday night when you don't normally go out on a Wednesday night.
Do things differently.
Yeah, do things differently.
Like, I've been doing this job for 10 years now.
Wow.
It's the longest by four times.
Wow.
It's four times longer than the previous thing that I did. Yeah. Previous length I held a job. So it's definitely, it's the tracks in your brain get so, or the habits get so wired in that it's just quite hard to break them.
Even that's interesting because, okay, you've been here for 10 years. How many changes have there been in that time?
Well, there's things I do, like when I grab the microphone to talk, right? I'm thinking that's a thing. Like, my brain has got that wired so much.
Mm.
And a while ago I was really tired and I had post-viral fatigue. like long COVID, but don't know if it was caused by COVID. And I was thinking, I could hear myself on the replay. I could hear that I sounded more tired than normal. I thought, I've got to bring more energy, so I've got to sit upright and, you know, right, open the chest up a bit. Mm-hmm. But as soon as my eyes went onto the thing I was going to read, the automatic part of my brain took over, and I ended up reading in the slightly slumped form that I, you know, that I normally do behind the microphone. And right, and it was really hard to break that habit. I couldn't do it. 9 times out of 10, I couldn't do it, even right, though every time I had the intention to do it.
Right.
Because that's, and that's, I'm presuming that's because of that. That's a movement I've done every day for 10 years.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So you'd have to probably put something there that would be a trigger to, for you to sit up straight and bring more energy to it.
I probably needed to stand up.
Yeah, I was going to say standing up, yeah, would be good as well.
But I've tried
then
that before.
You might not need a trigger to stand up to remind you to stand up.
Well, you can do that before, like once I'm on the air, I get into this flow.
Right.
And all the things that I normally do. But if I was standing up, then it'd be all right to be standing up. The only trouble is I can't reach the mouse properly, and it hurts my wrist. I've tried it. Anyway, enough about my problems. I'm still doing all right.
I was going to say something about the flexibility thing.
You want to challenge me on that?
No, go for it.
It's
just about because what I'm thinking is there's probably lots of changes that you've adapted to in that time. You know, like when I worked at the power company, when I first went there, I was personnel officer, and it was about power board, right? And the longest I'd ever stayed in a job before that was 18 months. In fact, the board that interviewed me, they said, you nearly didn't get the job because you've had so many jobs.
Right.
You know. But and I ended up staying there for 11 and a half years, which, and when I went there, I thought, God, you know, I'd been made redundant from the previous job. The whole thing closed down. And I thought, oh, well, I'll stay here for a couple of years and see how I go. And when I've been there for 11 and a half years, I couldn't believe it. But all that time, everything changed. Like, we became corporatized. The role expanded.
Yeah,
everything changed. And it was, like, constantly interesting for me and constantly new. And then I became corporate service manager and I had, you know, different things to do. So it was all of these things. It was change. And I enjoyed it, you know.
If it had stayed the same,
I wouldn't have lasted 2 years.
Yeah, well, some parts of this have changed, but other parts have stayed the same.
Mm.
The fun bits that have stayed the same, that's all good.
Yeah.
But the boring admin stuff that I have to do that stayed the same, I'm
less... Well, it's detail, isn't it?
It's detail. I just don't really want to do it, but, you know... Yeah.
Well, I'm like that with my GST return. I've got to do it every 2 months, but it's like, okay, well, suck it up and get on with it.
It's harder and harder to get motivated for it. Are we off track, folks? We're talking to Stephanie Philp, who is a neuro-linguistic programming trainer and a coach. Yeah. Coach you in business, coach you in life stuff. Inside Your Mind is the name of her business, and I stole that name for this segment because it's perfect. So we are listeners are probably thinking I'm getting some free counselling from you at the moment, but...
Yeah. I was giving you some examples of, you know, the sort of things that people get from coming on a practitioner training course. The other thing is, I think with people think that, you know, our practitioner training, it's called practitioner training, that they have to, you know, become an NLP practitioner and use it with other people. But really, if you think about the word practitioner, it's just somebody that practices something. So a lot of people do, you know, maybe do the practitioner training and then do my coaching course and become a coach. A lot of people just do it for their own personal development. That's why they come along to start with and then go, actually, I really like this stuff and I can see how valuable it is in the world and decide to continue on. Or other people just go, you know, I've just improved myself so much and the way that I relate to people and the work that I do and all that kind of stuff, and they're happy with that. So there's all different kinds of people that come on the practitioner course, and it doesn't have to be that they are going to, but they do get a qualification at the end of it, which is internationally recognised, you know.
Right. So they incorporate what they learned. It's not like teacher training where you only become a teacher.
Oh.
It's skills to be implemented everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got another example of...
Well, actually, teacher training, any course you've done, you could probably implement some of that.
They say that people at university, 3 months after they've left, they've forgotten about 80% of what they learned.
Yeah, because it's the exam system.
Yeah.
Because it's all about testing. Yeah. So it focuses on testing, not actually on...
Yeah, on learning.
The primary focus is on testing, not on learning. Yeah.
So another example was a guy who needed to make presentations to staff and company clients, and he just couldn't really do it. So firstly, he changed the way he thought about himself in front of an audience, and instead of imagining himself stuttering and stumbling and looking decidedly uncomfortable, he created some positive and inspiring images of how he wanted to be.
So there was a bit of a roadblock to start with.
Well, it is. It's like one of the things that we do is you know, like goal setting and called perfect outcomes. And the first part of the perfect stands for is an acronym for the different aspects of goal setting. Yep. And the first one is positive. So what's the positive outcome? Because often when I ask people what do they want, they'll tell me what they don't want. Like, yeah. I don't want to be stuttering in front of crowds of people. Right, okay, what do you want then? Oh, I don't want to be, you know, falling up on the stage and dropping all my stuff. Okay, so what do you want then? And they can't even think of what they want because they're constantly thinking about what they don't want.
Yeah.
And the more they think about what they don't want, the more that's what they do because that's what they're telling their unconscious mind is how they want to behave.
They're preparing to do a bad job.
They're preparing to do a bad job, but they don't realise it. So once they realise it and then they have this negative self-talk going on, like, oh, I'm bloody useless, I can't do this, and, you know, why am I even here? You know, all this kind of stuff, which, again, you know, I mean, that's going to make you nervous. So teaching people the impact of their language and what that has on their behaviour and how they actually feel is really important. And then so we helped him change his self-talk so that he used encouraging and empowering words like, you know, I've got this, I can do it, you know, I know what I'm talking about, etc. And then he used an NLP anchoring technique to settle into a powerful, energised state, rather than a nervous wreck state, right? And then, you know, we've talked before about Jeremy, who lives in Raglan here, who had this debilitating fear of public speaking, and now he's speaking to 500 or 600 people at award ceremonies that he's getting.
I saw Jeremy speak once before he'd been to see you, and he was rare. He was super nervous.
He was really nervous, yeah. And then, so another one, a woman who was a nurse in the ICU, and she learned the power of language, and not only did she learn how she could change her mood by changing the self-talk, but also how she could help her patients heal more quickly by the way she spoke to them, and using some hypnotic-type language that we use on the second block of the course. And then another guy got a job because he learned how to build rapport with people. And he got his dream job after a 1.5-hour interview, and where he stayed in rapport with the people.
Right.
People have improved their relationships. And I think the thing is, like, these are odd examples, but each person is going to get all of these and more. In fact, you know, it's called the Inside Your Mind, Inside Out Challenge. Inside Your Mind, Inside Out Guarantee.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is, if you don't see, hear, and feel the difference at the end of the course, you get your money back.
Has anyone asked?
No. No. Because, you know, other people can see it. They can see it. They feel it. They give me testimonials to tell me how much they've changed. So, never had to give anybody the money back.
That's good.
And in 23 years, that's not too bad. And nobody's even asked.
You probably wouldn't have mentioned it if there was a long list of people who'd asked for their money back. You probably wouldn't have brought that up.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's another thing. So, you know, when people are looking at training, it's important to think about what they want to achieve. Because sometimes people, you know, people have been on my courses, they've already done NLP somewhere else and told me that they paid a fortune for like a 3-day course or something. And really all they're paying for is the marketing of it. And then when they do the course, they've got like 3 days worth. Or they go, oh, well, I did a 7-day NLP course and now I can't get it recognised by anybody. And I go, well, that's because you need 18 days. But it was an advanced, you know, advanced learning thing. I go, yeah, mine's advanced learning as well. I still can't teach 18 days in 7.
Were they being taught, like, they're just getting the info dump rather than training?
Exactly, yeah. They're being told stuff and not getting any practice in it.
Yeah.
Or they're experienced, the trainer's using it. When I've asked them, you know, did you learn this? Oh, I think the trainer's used that. Okay, did you practice it? No. Okay, so then they haven't learnt it, you know, because it's just used on them, but not they haven't used it, so they can't practice it.
Any kind of educational training setting where you're not doing things and it's just going in through your eyes or your ears, is going to be a poor, it's a very poor way to learn. And that's what my whole degree was done. Well, not my whole degree, but, you know, most people who've done degrees have, that's been the reality of that. And we used to joke, I used to meet my classmates when we all started working and we'd joke about how useless our degrees were. You know, it'd be like, did you do anything today that involved something you learned from your degree? And it'd just be laughter, you know.
Yeah,
that was a real experience I had many times, bumping into old classmates.
And not feeling that you embodied that learning. And, you know, I mean, I've probably spent the price of a small house on training over the years for myself, personally. And some of them have been, you know, good, and other ones I've got, that was just a rip-off. You know, I've learnt nothing. You know, I've got head knowledge, but I can't do anything with it. It's not what I signed up for, you know.
Do you ask now? Do you ask questions going into it?
Yeah, I do. And the other thing...
So what do you ask? Tell us what you ask. Because this might be useful to people.
I'm asking what I'm going to learn, what I'm going to have at the end of the day, how much time is spent in practice and all that kind of stuff. It depends, you know, what the course is and what I want to get out of it. And I think, you know, like, because my course is 18 days, you know, quite often I'll have people that ring me up about it and they want to know, they want to ask questions. And that's like, that's absolutely fine. I don't expect people to invest the money because it's $4,195 for 18 days.
Okay,
you know?
Right.
Because it's a very expensive course to run. You know, there's certificates to pay for, manuals, venue. You know, it's quite an expensive course to pay for it and, you know, to get the qualification at the end of it. So, you know, I want people to, they come on the course to feel comfortable that it's the right course for them. And so, you know, they'll ring me up and I was telling you off air.
I was just going to bring that up. Yeah. The lady who paid for three family members to...
She came on my very first practitioner training in 2000 and she rang me up on Saturday and said, I want to pay for two of my Mokopuna to come on your course and I only trust you and you're still doing it and can I bring... And I went, that's fantastic. Yeah, she said it's my legacy to them.
Yeah, okay.
And then she rang me up yesterday and said, I've got another one. So she's paying for three to come on the course.
Yeah.
Because she changed her life, absolutely changed her life. And now she's doing all these amazing things in the world and helping, you know, abused children and adults to get their lives back on track. And, yeah, she's doing amazing
Which
things.
Which is a tough thing to be doing.
It's a tough thing to be doing, exactly. And so she said, I've been using it on them all the time, but they don't know. She says, but now she said, I want them to, you know, she said, I've got them interested in it and they want to come. And then yesterday she talked to another one and that one is going to come as well. So it's life changing. And the thing is as well, Aaron, is when one person, say in a family, when one person changes, it affects everybody. If they can hold that change, then it has to have an impact on the people around them because they won't be able to relate to that person that came on the course in the same way. They have to change their reactions to that person. We're all really, really powerful. We just need to step into our power and learn how to use it to our own and other people's benefit so that we can be the best version of ourselves that we can be. And, you know, that's kind of what people get. I mean, my company was called Metamorphosis, which means transformation, and that's what it is. You don't usually get that from a one-day training. You have to invest the time. It's usually three things you have to invest: time, energy, and money. So you have to bring your best self each day. You have to pay for it, and you have to commit to the time to do it. You know. And people will commit to going on holiday for 2 weeks, you know. So if they want to see a transformation, they'll commit to
Well, for a lot of people, they come into Raglan, so they're kind of going on holiday anyway. They're coming to a holiday town.
Well, that was the reason I decided when I came here 14 years ago is I wanted to run it here because I thought it, and I wanted to run it in the winter when it's the off season. And when I first came here, you know, you could
nothing
fire a
was
bullet
happening
down the main street in the winter and yeah. never hit anybody, you know.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, if I bring people to Raglan to do the course, then they'll love Raglan and they'll come back. And they spend money when they're here, so they pay yeah. for accommodation when they're here. They go out to dinner. They usually buy gifts for people. They go out for lunch. And then they come back every other weekend and ring me up and say, do you want to have a coffee? I'm in Raglan. So they come back and spend money here. So it was like a win-win-win.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have run it in Auckland, but, you know, I don't want to. I'd rather bring people here.
And you'd have to travel to Auckland.
Yeah, well, that's your downside as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And we all, most people in Raglan, the whole point of being here is because you're not in places like Auckland.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, one of the people I spoke to yesterday that's been paid for, she said she comes to Raglan quite often already. So she yeah. thinks it's like paradise coming for a training course.
It's actually really easy to get people to come to Raglan. Sometimes I'm interviewing people and they're like, oh, come out. And I'm like, you don't have to. We've got a phone. You know, it's all right. And they're like, no, I want to come out. So, yeah. Anyway, I think we're pretty much wrapping ourselves up here, aren't we?
Maybe if I just say to people that they can, if they're interested in the practitioner training, there is an early bird rate which finishes on the 21st of July.
Now that they've heard how much it actually costs.
Yeah, well, that's the early bird rate. And it's on the website, it's in American dollars. So if they, because it's a .com and I won't go into explanation of all that, but they can get hold of me and give me a call on, well, they can ring me 021-684-395 or they can email me steph@insideyourmind.com and I'd be really happy to talk to anybody that's, you know, genuinely interested in change and transformation and what it can do for them, their families and not, you know, the wider society. The more people that know this, the better, you know.
Yeah, some of it seems like real basic practical stuff that we should learn at school or somewhere.
Well, that's
early
what everybody
in life.
Says. Everybody comes on the course go, why didn't we learn this at school?
Yeah, I know, because I've said that to you too before after some of our interviews.